Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kalik, and this is Dispatches. Tunisia is where the Arab uprisings erupted in December 2010, spreading east and ushering 10 years of change, chaos, and wars. Tunisia is also the only country of the Arab Spring that could claim some success in transitioning to democracy, though it has suffered economic turmoil in the years that followed. Outside observers not following events in the North African country closely were shocked to hear that Tunisia's president ousted the government and froze parliament using the army. Some Tunisians are celebrating what has been denounced by some as a coup, and there are allegations of Emirati assistance. Is this a minor constitutional crisis, an economic uprising, or a coup against a Muslim Brotherhood government just like Morsi's in Egypt in 2013? Joining me is journalist and researcher Fadhel Ali Riza, who is based in Tunisia. He's also founder and editor-in-chief of Mishkal, an independent outlet I encourage everyone to check out. Fadhel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, my pleasure.
So just really quickly, for those who are watching, make sure to subscribe. And just a reminder, you can also listen to every episode of Rania Kalik Dispatches as a podcast, anywhere you get podcasts. And for those who are listening, you can watch every episode on Breakthrough News on YouTube. So to the topic at hand, Fadhel, let's begin with, can you explain what the Tunisian president just did? Because I don't think it's very difficult to follow with all the developments coming in so quickly.
Sure. So on Sunday night, after protests that we saw basically around the country, about a dozen cities across Tunisia, but particularly in front of parliament, he decided at night to have a meeting with some security officials. And he said he was basically taking emergency powers. He cited Article 80 of the Tunisian Constitution. This is a 2014 constitution that was passed after Tunisia's revolution or uprising in 2011. And under these, he said that he would be freezing parliament. He would be dismissing the prime minister, Prime Minister Hichem Mishishi, and he would also be lifting immunity of parliamentarians. And he would also give himself a power of prosecution. Many people have pointed to Article 80. It's quite vague. So a lot of the specifics that he cited aren't actually available in Article 80. Some people have said he's used other constitutional amendments to justify it. Maybe he didn't say them explicitly. But this is the argument he made. And then shortly after that, we saw people take to the streets. People were very, very happy with this because of many reasons, but primarily because they had been extremely disillusioned with the previous government, the prime minister, with the parliament as a whole, seen as a very corrupt institution by many Tunisians. When parliamentarians, particularly the leading party, the party with the most seats, the Islamist party, Ennahda, when they tried to enter parliament early in the morning, and they were actually prevented by the military. So the military followed through on what the president called for, took to the parliament and blocked the doors.
Yeah, I definitely, of course, want to get into what led to this. But first, I'm curious, you know, there's been so many different narratives going around, especially online. So from your perspective, is this a coup, or does it have a legitimate basis?
I think honestly, it's a little early to tell. This is certainly something that the president has done, but I think it's important to remember that Tunisia does not have a very strong military. They don't have a military that has economic sort of tendrils throughout society, like an Egypt scenario. Traditionally, the military hasn't played a very important role. Although in 1987, there was a constitutional coup led by Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, which was, he was a former military guy. And he used the military to say that the Habib Bourguiba, the first president of Tunisia, due to medical reasons, was unable to govern. So some people have pointed to that, saying perhaps this is a sort of a constitutional coup, although Kais Saied himself is not a military person. But most of the people who are saying this is a coup, the people who are making that argument, have largely been Ennahda supporters. They've been the most vocal. They have the most to lose since they have the Speaker of Parliament. They've been in charge of Parliament. They've been the biggest supporters of Prime Minister Hichem Mishishi and his government, which has been governing for the last several months. There have been some who've also said that it's a coup in Tunisia among academics, scholars, some on the left. But I would say most of the population was not using the term. Many organizations, institutions, even institutions that are maybe trying to carve out some independence from the president and the new powers he's given himself, even they haven't really used the word inqilab, a coup. They're sort of making their criticisms without using that term. And I would say, you know, there's probably a good majority of Tunisians who are happy with the decision at the moment. That may change depending on the measures that the president takes now that he's given to himself these powers and is ruling by executive decree.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there's also a lot of the same people who are calling it a coup are making comparisons to Egypt. But, you know, unlike in Egypt, the Tunisian military is comparatively weak. So what would you say is the role of security forces in what just happened in Tunisia, and if there is one?
Certainly, there's a role for security forces. The fact that they have followed through on the president's orders is key. The fact that they blocked parliament, this is enough. It's a very important step that they've taken. It shows that they're following orders directly from the president. We're talking about mainly the military, but also the police. But it's important to remember that the military and police are two very different institutions in Tunisia. The police are generally seen as extremely repressive, having been quite politicized under Ben Ali and politicized even since then now with sort of divisions and different loyalties and, to different business interests or different political parties. So far, we haven't seen those divisions between security forces playing out. There seems to have been sort of, like I would say the Tunisian population as a whole, a general consensus that Kais Saied's decision was legitimate.
And then, of course, this is the big question that everybody's wondering, what led to this? Because, you know, and you've written pretty extensively about what led to this, but what did cause this to happen? There's been protests taking place for months. There's been a lot of there's many grievances among the Tunisian population. So how did we get to this?
It depends where you want to start the clock. I mean, I think maybe most immediate has been the health crisis, the fact that Tunisia has seen one of the worst death rates in the world per capita in recent weeks. You know, this is not just because a lack of vaccines, although that does certainly play into it, particularly the fact that Tunisia was unable to acquire vaccines. You know, there hasn't been technology transfer, even though Tunisia has the capacity. I mean, we spoke to someone from the WHO representative in Tunisia, said Tunisia has the capacity to make vaccines. There just needs to be technology transfer. Why shouldn't they be able to make it at home? But they haven't been able to purchase them either. They haven't managed to get enough through the COVAX system, which is the WHO's system. So that's been one factor. But the other factor has been that, you know, there hasn't been enough staff at hospitals. There hasn't been enough equipment. There hasn't been enough oxygen. There hasn't been basic materials at hospitals. And that's really the legacy of, unfortunately, at least a decade of austerity policies, where there has been, because of some of the conditions of international loan programs, a complete freeze on public sector hiring across the board, including doctors. So, you know, doctors who graduate in Tunisia often don't find themselves with a job, or they end up traveling abroad to places where they have decent salaries, will be able to enjoy a typical middle-class life with a typical middle-class salary after all the years of study they had in medical school. So those are structural, but this particular government, this last government that was dismissed, was particularly seen as really having failing to give a key response to the COVID crisis. You know, 2 days after he had Tunisia saw the worst death rate it had ever had, we saw images of the prime minister and his whole team of ministers lounging at a luxury hotel in a seaside resort. And these were leaked actually by an anti-corruption NGO. These were sort of publicized by an anti-corruption NGO, you know, saying, you know, this is not affordable on a prime minister's salary, this five-star hotel. And they were doing this in a moment when Tunisians in many cities of around the country were forced to stay at home due to what they said were you know, COVID restrictions, saying, you know, no travel restrictions, and people were really sort of relegated to their neighborhoods or were not able to travel without authorization. There weren't transportation links if people wanted to go and cool off in some of these you know, record-breaking temperatures we've had by the sea or visit friends or family, they weren't able to. So I think some of those really played into that, seeing the president sort of lounging, you know, not really taking an active communication role or even, you know, doing a lot to really make the case for Tunisia on the world stage, saying, you know, either demanding equipment or requesting equipment and saying that this is a real crisis that needs to be addressed immediately. So that was the sort of the main trigger, I think, is really this disconnect between images we've seen of hospitals and hospital staff who are in tears over the their incapacity to treat their patients, with sort of the way that the prime minister and his team have been conducting themselves, but also an economic crisis that's gotten worse, particularly in the last couple months, as the government has raised prices of basic consumer goods like sugar. They've reduced subsidies on sugar. They've raised prices of several other goods. They've declined to put price caps, and some people have pointed to this and said this is because Tunisia is currently in negotiations for a new loan agreement with the IMF. Tunisia has several public debts that have all fallen in this year alone. So they need a loan to pay off old loans. It's sort of a debt cycle. But it's something that they're apparently, they may have taken the decision to raise prices in June and even earlier, some prices of drinking water and some other commodities as a result of trying to show the IMF that they're serious about austerity policies.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what you just described, I feel like the conditions can be applied to so many countries. So in some ways, you know, this may be a kind of lens into the future of what could happen at other places in this sort of post-COVID era mixed with extreme neoliberalization that's been going on for years. But I'm curious, you know, between the president and the prime minister, is there an actual difference in the policies that are advocated by these two people, the president as opposed to the prime minister?
And the prime minister really didn't seem to be advocating policies. I mean, he seemed to be catching up either to Tunisians themselves, who many of them went out as volunteers for as you know, health volunteers, people who've been giving to charities, people who've been doing you know, trying to organize networks with diaspora in France and Italy and in other countries to try and coordinate medical aid. You know, Tunisians themselves felt like they were often alone in trying to push the policy with the government, you know, sort of catching up afterwards. The president himself probably was a little bit more proactive. I mean, he was really on the phone trying to make sure that he could secure donations from Tunisia's international partners, whether that was donations of oxygen or masks, basic materials, as well as vaccines. You know, the difference really was about, you know, how active and how in front of this crisis they were. It was very clear to almost everyone that the prime minister and his team were not on top of this at all. And when they did do a last minute sort of walk-in vaccination centers that they had announced last week, they closed within a day because they had given volunteers a 1 day notice. They hadn't given out enough vaccines to all the centers to meet the demand of people. You saw extreme crowding because of the lack of organization. People were saying this may even make the spread even worse at this moment. So, you know, you just saw crises across the board that were really at the level of the prime minister, not really taking an active step in trying to mitigate the situation, you know, even in small ways.
Jeez. And we saw similar protests about the economy, you know, in marginalized towns in the South in 2020 and elsewhere in 2018. Are the grievances today connected at all to those protests a couple years ago?
I think there's sort of a general issue of since 2011, many people feel that the revolution, you know, whatever they believed in from the revolution, has not been realized. That's certainly the case of people, you know, whether it is in you know, southern regions of the country that are resource rich, who have seen that the in fact there hasn't been any redistribution, even though they have been continuing to export to foreign markets, whether it's phosphates, whether it's agricultural goods like dates and olives, you know, whether it's hydrocarbon products, and they're not seeing any of that money coming back to their communities to see you know, investment in public services. That's certainly been the case. You know, people have felt like 2011 onwards, there hasn't been a real acknowledgement of the demands of the revolution for economic development, for fair redistribution of wealth in the country, for even just, you know, more opportunities and more economic opportunities for people. And of course, that is on a regional basis as well. You definitely see that interior regions, southern regions, you know, see that there's quite a big disconnect between coastal regions, which traditionally have been sort of the richer and wealthier, not necessarily by virtue of their resources, but because this is where you know, the profits are sort of concentrated, and development by the state and state institutions is carried out you know, with a lot more regularity, with better services, you know, just a lot more capital there.
Yeah, I feel like in a lot of the Middle Eastern countries where there was these uprisings, there was a lack of connecting the issue of economics to sort of the mainstream discourse. A lot of it was about very important things like, you know, freedom from autocracy and more political freedoms. But a lot of times the economies didn't change, or in some cases they got worse. But, you know, can you talk about the Kamour movement? I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. There was the Kamour movement of 2017. Can you talk a little bit about that and tell our audience what that was about?
Sure. Yeah, this was a group of people in Tatooine, one of the southern governorates, who decided to shut off a key oil transportation node. So they basically took over this pumping station, and they shut the taps, demanding new jobs, demanding jobs. Whether the jobs be, you know, in the sector itself, but also they wanted jobs, you know, in issues relating to environmental management, landscaping, you know, ecological development. You know, we have seen that, you know, when unfortunately jobs are created, they aren't necessarily with you know, a plan or a vision in mind. These were basically people saying, you know, we understand that there's ecological crises, you know, there's clear environmental crises in our region. And if we're going to have jobs, if we're going to have development, if we're going to be basically having these resources exported from our land, then we should see the benefits from this. We should be able to use the profits for that to reinvest in our region. And that's particularly pressing in Tatooine, but other southern regions where there's very few doctors per capita. There's you know, almost no investment in education. You know, schools are falling apart. You know, you can see people sharing photos of you know, school buildings that you know, are basically in tatters. There's almost no public transportation. In many ways, they're disconnected from other regions of the country. You know, people from interior regions are sometimes discriminated against in the capital when they do manage to travel. They, you know, they're just sort of seen as not necessarily belonging in a rich you know, coastal area. So all of those sort of marginalization, discrimination, and really extraction and exploitation of resources without redistribution back to their areas, we're at the key of the Kamour movement to really shut down the transportation of hydrocarbon resources from there. And there were, you know, there were sort of agreements at the time. There's been sort of a series of agreements that the government has sort of to try and, you know, buy some peace for a little bit. A series of governments have signed a series of agreements. You know, people will sort of say, okay, we'll give them some time to live up to these agreements. And when they eventually do not live up to the agreements in terms of, you know, increasing sort of hiring or creation of, new sort of public bodies that could deal with local issues. Then people go back into the streets, or people go back to, in the case of Kamwar, to the pumping station. Unfortunately, there has been relatively little news of it. It only really makes the headlines when it's something that's shut down for a while, and when you start to see confrontations. You know, oftentimes the state doesn't just respond with agreements for yes, we'll give you some of your demands, but also they'll send security forces. And there has been at least one person who was killed in Kamwar when what we heard was a security force vehicle ran him over. There was tents, there was a sit-in, and he was run over by a security force vehicle. Since then we haven't really seen the government actually doing much to respond to the demands of people there.
Is it fair to say that the center of Tunisia has been favored at the expense of its periphery?
Yes, definitely. People have also made the argument that this is sort of a continuation of colonialism at a national scale, that there's sort of the coastal regions who benefit from the resources of, whether it's water resources or agricultural products or hydrocarbon products, phosphates. These are sort of exported in an export model that really ramped up from the 1970s onwards, the profits of that were reinvested into coastal areas. The first president, Habib Bourguiba, after independence, was from Monastir. He invested quite a lot into Monastir and surrounding areas. Ben Ali himself was from a coastal area. They call it the Sahel. Sahel is well known as being the home of many of the elites in governance. Only after 2011 have we really started to see even elites from the south being allowed into governing positions or being allowed into key positions even in the military or other institutions of the state. If you go to northwest Tunisia, you'll see that people, one of the richest, perhaps I think it is the richest in terms of water resources. I've spoken to farmers there and who've said that actually the water resources that are supposed to be for our products are all redirected towards the Sahel, to this coastal area, to the east of them, who are mainly producing for export to Europe, and not necessarily producing for a domestic market. And certainly, food sovereignty activists, there is the quite a few groups that are working on food sovereignty, have tried to connect people to policymakers and farmers to try and talk about this issue in terms of what this could mean in terms of redeveloping policy towards a food sovereignty approach, one where water resources might be used more for feeding domestic food markets rather than necessarily an export model, which oftentimes leads to a lot of inequality, regionally as well.
Post 2011 governments did adopt a regional development program to help the marginalized periphery. So what happened with that?
You're talking about international, international financial institutions and international development organizations in generally?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I from what I understood, the actual, is that not correct that the post 2011 governments in Tunisia adopted these kind of regional development programs to help people in these marginalized areas? There was a promise of that. Did that not actually help? And was that a part of financial institutions outside of Tunisia?
There was absolutely. I think a lot of it ended up being a more rhetoric than facts on the ground in terms of redistribution to marginalized areas. You did see at the beginning, like Sidi Bouzid, the place where Mohamed Bouazizi, set himself on fire and really started the whole revolution in many ways. That's a city in the marginalized south that did receive quite a lot of investment, but, you know, really in the center, like in the center of town, but not necessarily, you know, in the governorate as a whole, which is a largely, agricultural governorate. That's really the richness of the region. That's the resources that they have. And if you talk to rural people, you know, we've done reports on it. We've heard other reports on, rural people in Sidi Bouzid or Kasrine, who are, they say they often get cut off from water. I mean, they often don't have access to water, especially during the summer months. I mean, you'll see 3 or 4 months where people in rural areas will have to walk many miles before they can find a water source. So that really hasn't changed, and it hasn't been a priority for successive governments since then. There has been sort of a talk of decentralization, and there has been, on a legal level, in a legal framework level, there has been a level of decentralization. You know, they had the first municipal elections in, I believe it was 2016 or 17. I covered them, but it's I don't remember exactly the date. But those municipal elections, for a lot of people would say that they didn't live up to expectations. You can elect municipal councillors, but you still have a governor system where the governor is appointed by the government in Tunis. And they have a lot more power in many ways than city councillors, than city officials. They control a lot of the funding and the financing. Ministries control in Tunis control a lot of the funding and financing. So there isn't a lot of possibility for people to create their own sort of development solutions that are really tailored for what they need. And sometimes their needs are really basic. I mean, it could be just access to water. It could often be, just basic services, basic transportation that is still lacking.
You know, this is a bit of a tangential issue, but the Tunisian parliament recently banned normalization with Israel, which was interesting. Is there a strong Arab nationalist movement in the country and a strong solidarity with Palestine, or was that just something that was done by the people, like in power for political reasons? Because it was kind of unexpected, but maybe that, maybe it shouldn't have been unexpected. I don't know. What do you think?
I think solidarity with Palestine is extremely popular among the Tunisian population. It's something that's stayed pretty consistent over the decades. Of course, Tunisia hosted the PLO, and even was bombed by Israel in the 80s. So, this is something that people feel viscerally. You know, Tunisians feel like they've lost their lives. It is part of this what they see as a broader Arab nationalist struggle against Israel and Zionism. So that's something that people feel quite strongly, and you see it reproduced year after year among especially student unions. The student unions have consistently put Palestine at the as one of their main causes. Even football clubs. I mean, football clubs, there's quite a lot of politicized football clubs that are basically clubs that in many ways have traditionally faced off against state forces, against police. But they've always sort of, put Palestinian banners, at their games. Sometimes they've even been banned from it because oftentimes officials are not necessarily as happy with the pro-Palestinian stance of some of the grassroots organizations, whether they be football clubs or student unions or the union itself. But really, now with I would say since 2011, because of more democratic mechanisms, officials have really had to take a stronger pro-Palestinian line to really satisfy what is a very popular cause among Tunisians. I've heard sort of diplomats and elite diplomats who are sort of actually upset about this, people who would actually prefer to have relations with Israel. This is a small elite who, used to prefer Ben Ali and the dictatorships allowing them to have very quiet relations with Israeli diplomats or to very quietly allow Israelis to visit Tunisia. And since then, there have been a few cases we've seen when Israelis seem to have visited Tunisia either for tourism or in cases where there's been actually Tunisian companies selling to Israel, where it's been quite a scandal. It's been a scandal and people have really pointed to it and forced officials to take a stronger line to try and reduce normalization or get rid of normalization entirely.
Well, it is refreshing that there are still countries that don't want to normalize with Israel. You know, stepping back a bit, and this is going back to the issue of Tunisia and the post-2011 era, can you tell us, you already talked about some of the reasons, but can you tell us what went wrong in Tunisia and how much of the failure we can blame on the adoption of these neoliberal policies and austerity measures that you referenced earlier?
Do you mean what went wrong that led to 2011?
No, sorry. Post 2011, right. There was all this promise, right? But now we're kind of, I wouldn't say back where we started or anything, but obviously there's a political crisis right now. So between 2011 and now, you know, what went wrong and how much of the failure of that sort of 2011 promise can be blamed on these neoliberal policies and austerity measures that you referenced earlier?
I think the large part of it is because of neoliberal policies and economic policies that I've identified briefly. I mean, there's other levels as well. I mean, certainly the sort of focus on Islamists versus secularists and the way that this was sort of mediatized and put into the context of, you know, regional dynamics. You know, it was oftentimes a distraction from really having, fundamental changes that might actually see a Tunisian state that could meet the needs and demands of the Tunisian people. You know, it's certainly in 2013 when you had the coup in Egypt, you know, there was almost a sort of a similar situation in Tunisia at the time. And you had a real sort of mobilization between supporters of the Ennahda Islamist Party versus, you know, secularists. But there were so many other issues at play that really didn't, that didn't really fit into this neat narrative. In some ways, it was a real distraction from the demands of the revolution. Yeah, but that said, you know, I would say primarily it's been the economic issues that have really led to the failure we've seen. And this is what people talk about. I mean, when people are nostalgic for the old regime, the number one thing they say is, the sort of the prices of goods. I mean, you know, we could live a much better life under Ben Ali. You know, people will also point to maybe security issues, but really it's their pocketbooks that they felt it the worst since 2011. You know, debt to GDP was about 40% in about 2013. You know, not a high number, but there were officials in the government who decided that they thought it was necessary to sign a deal with the IMF. At that time, there were people in parliament, in the transitional sort of parliament that was writing the constitution, who were saying, we don't want to sign an IMF deal. We don't think Tunisia needs it, and we think that the parliament should have a right to vote on it. But they weren't given the right to vote on it, and instead they had signed an IMF deal. So that was 2013. Debt to GDP was 40%. Now it's about 90%, or close to 100%. So that's after 7 years and more of an IMF loan. You know, and unemployment hasn't gotten better. If anything, it's gotten worse. You've seen inflation get much worse because one of the conditions of this loan was also the devaluation of the dinar. You saw the independence of the central bank, quote unquote independence, because it's not necessarily independent from international financial markets or international financial institutions, but it has become independent from the elected officials of Tunisia. Even in the U.S., the Federal Reserve has unemployment as one of the goals, trying to reduce unemployment. In Tunisia, that's not the case. The central bank, you know, now with its independence, means that it's unable to lend to the Tunisian government as much as it wants. If it wants to have sort of a monetary policy that it would like to use to sort of try and reduce unemployment, to maybe create jobs at home, some of them that you don't really need foreign currency for. You could just use dinars to sort of create jobs that are desperately needed, whether that's in education or healthcare or even environmental or landscaping or gardening. You know, all of those are, or even agriculture. I mean, those are all sort of the things that the government has really been cut off from. It's really lost its ability to create an independent and sovereign economic policy as a result of some of these changes. And because of that, we've seen that Tunisia is now almost completely dependent on loans. It's in what people would say is sort of a really debt spiral. And this is why there's been so much pressure in the last few months for Tunisia to sign a new deal with the IMF so that Tunisia can pay off its old debts.
That's So frustrating, the debt spiral. You mentioned something that I'd love for you to elaborate on, because I think it's a really interesting dynamic that's replicated in a lot of different countries in the Middle East. You mentioned this sort of Islamist secularist debate, right? This polarization, or at least the discourse around this polarization, where secular society becomes this kind of main object of contestation. And especially, this seems to be a conversation, especially among wealthier people, that at least in the context of a place like Lebanon, often distracts from the class structure. I don't want to impose that onto Tunisia, but I'm curious if you kind of see it that way, that the Islamist secularist polarization, that debate as kind of distracting or overshadowing the issue of class.
No, absolutely, it's distracted and overshadowed the issue of class, and it's a technique, it's a tactic that Ben Ali used quite well. It's a tactic that Bourguiba used quite well for decades. I mean, there was just constant propaganda against the Ennahda party. It was very easy to say that any of the ills that were happening in society, any of the sort of negative things that were happening, they blamed them on the Ennahda Islamist party. I'm not a fan of the Ennahda Islamist Party. I think there's a lot of very, very valid critiques of them, I think, especially after 2011. They too were, victims of the regime, but they were not, they were certainly also made scapegoats. I mean, it was very easy for people to sort of even rally behind, the sort of conservative vision of Ben Ali, even people who would, previously have called themselves maybe, leftist critics of the regime, or people who might have called themselves, even maybe nationalist critics of the Ben Ali regime, sort of accepted, his way of framing things, that, if it's not me, it's going to be the Islamists. Since 2011, people have said, look at how much more violence there has been in other countries, where there's been this sort of, fight against Islamists, whether that's Syria or Libya or Egypt. We don't want to be like them. So if you don't want to be like them, then you're just going to put your faith in, a state institution, that might be quite conservative. It might be quite neoliberal in its policies. You might end up not being quite as critical of them or thinking of alternatives to them. You end up seeing some consolidation around what is technically, in many ways, a neoliberal regime.
And this kind of connects to the next question I have, which, Tunisia also suffered from terrible terror attacks by jihadis since its revolution. Can you tell us why, and is there an economic link? Because Tunisia is reputed to be the secular country, right? Yet it's provided so many fighters for ISIS in places like Syria and Iraq and Libya. How did that happen? And I'm curious if that does have anything, if you could connect it at all to maybe the displacement of people from land. I know in a place like Iraq, some of the people who then, ended up being fighters for ISIS, not all of them, but there was to some extent people who were pushed out of their agricultural land by like decades of sanctions and war, and ended up in cities kind of unemployed, jobless, they kind of went the ISIS route. So I'm curious if there's something similar that happened with Tunisia, or if you can speak to that economic link.
Yeah, unfortunately, in the case of Tunisia, I think the jihadi threat has been blown up by elements of the state itself as an attempt to sort of distract from maybe class issues oftentimes, or questions of socioeconomic justice, in the sense that there are plenty of people who are suffering from poverty in Tunisia, who are completely desperate, and the people who are truly desperate, I would say many of them end up sort of lingering in sort of slums around big cities like Tunis. These are people who are maybe a generation before their parents had come from agricultural areas, but were displaced by concentration of agricultural land and resources and water in the hands of a few key exporters, maybe with good political connections. I would say most people are sort of that's where a lot of the people who find themselves quite desperate are in, or people going to Europe, going on boats, rickety boats, risking their lives, many of them dying, never making it back, to try and live a better life in a country in Europe where they think maybe they'll have a better job, maybe they'll have a better salary, maybe they'll have a better chance of making a life for themselves and then coming back. I mean, most Tunisians who do want to travel to Europe want to make some money and then come back. I mean, that's what their parents did a generation before. And then suddenly the borders went up and people can no longer do that. You can't have seasonal work. You can't have work for a few years and then come back. You know, you either find yourself on one side of the border or another, which, and especially now that it's become so much more deadly, the stakes are much higher. I would say that's where the majority of people who are truly, desperate or impoverished, if they find themselves, without any real hope would go. And then a very tiny majority of minority of those would end up as extremists, as jihadis. As people who see themselves as maybe Salafis who see that taking up arms against either the Tunisian state or other states in the region, but at the time the security officials in Tunisia, I mean, all of the numbers of at some point Tunisia was touted as having the most jihadis it was exporting, that was actually working really well for the it served a purpose. In the eyes of security forces in Tunisia, in the Ministry of Interior at the time, wanted actually more resources, more assistance, more arms from the United States. They were getting quite a lot of assistance from the United States, and they wanted more of it. I think it's a good argument for them to make to say, hey, we need your help to really strengthen our security forces because look at the threat that we have. So I think in that sense, they might have been more honest than other people in terms of numbers, or at least they might have been really pointing to it and publicizing it as a negotiating tool at the time. And I think some people within the security forces who wanted to use it, or at least some people within the state, were very sort of happy to talk about the problem of jihadism to really lay the blame on another. Again, like we said earlier about distracting from socioeconomic issues and saying the real challenge right now is the war against terror and not necessarily trying to really meet the demands of the revolution for a fairer, more equitable Tunisia.
Yeah, and then that's the use, right? I mean, there's that can be said of so many different governments, is the actual use of the ISIS issue. And on top of that, it's also kind of a way, I don't know if this is the case for Tunisia's security forces, but I think for some Western countries, they kind of appreciated that there was these places for the people with these ideologies in their own countries to go to, because at least you kind of get rid of it and make it someone else's problem, right? It becomes Syria's problem or Libya's problem rather than your problem. That said,
with France, there were a couple of highly publicized, attacks there, which, unfortunately, if anything, put sort of Tunisia on the defensive, maybe put migration again as the sort of, boogeyman of, we need to close down borders of Europe. These are dangerous countries that, in their telling of it that we need to prevent against. So unfortunately, the right wing in Europe was also sort of boosted the few times that we did see, jihadi attacks in Europe.
Oh yeah, it totally ends up benefiting certain political players, particularly the right. But and then the same thing happened in the U.S. as well. It completely benefited the right to have these attacks taking place in Western countries. That said, is there any political party in Tunisia that has a serious solution to the challenges that most Tunisians face?
I would say that most Tunisians really don't trust political parties, and that's been the case, since 2011 with increasing. You can see that there's less and less people who turn out for parliamentary elections. If you have a serious program, you're most likely not just going to start a party because you know already that that's going to reduce your legitimacy. People are going to immediately, distrust you. There have been sort of leftist parties that have tried to say that economic issues are really key, but they're not at all popular. Some of them are seen as quite elitist. Really sort of the most popular parties that we've seen, Nahda, continuously outperform other parties. Not only because they were seen as the revolutionary party in many ways, they were seen as the biggest party that suffered under Ben Ali, and so they were really the in some ways the bearers of the revolution, but they've actually brought in some Ben Ali officials in recent years. And they've actually voted against, they voted for immunity and even impunity for old Ben Ali officials. They've sort of tried to make sure that they outflank their right-wing opponents by bringing some of them into their tent. So they've been quite smart about their politics up until this moment, where they seem to be completely excluded. There's been some Arab nationalist parties that in recent the last elections kind of surprised everyone, like Harakat al-Shaab, which is sort of an Arab nationalist party that is a lot more comfortable with maybe the language of religion than the previous sort of secular Marxist-Leninist parties that have completely lost not even a seat in the last parliament. This last parliament, the left, people would say the left is completely collapsed. There is a sort of a center-left party of some lawyers who are their whole focus has been on anti-corruption. They really make legal arguments for holding different sectors of the state accountable. They're the third biggest party in parliament, I believe. So they managed to do well, and they have a small vocal support. But the problem is also that parliament is so divided. I mean, there's no sort of barrier to entry for parliament. So you have dozens of parties represented, and then these different blocks that shift and change party affiliate. People has changing affiliation in the parliament, so that's another reason that people have really sort of distrusted political parties as a vehicle for sort of making change in Tunisia.
So you mentioned, okay, so let's talk about the left now, right? My audience is mostly, Western leftists. So we have to talk about the left in Tunisia. You mentioned that there's a kind of weakness. They don't even have a seat in parliament, at least the Marxist organizations. So let's step back for a second. Can you tell me about the political left in Tunisia, both the organized and disorganized left? Along what lines are they organized? Are they effective? If not, why aren't they? Do they have any representation at all? It sounds to me, you're talking about this place that has, a lot of revolutionary potential among the population. Obviously, they've had a revolution before, more than once. So why is the left so weak?
It depends what you think of as left. I mean, the UGTT, the main labor union, is still an extremely strong player. I mean, recently they put out a statement calling on American labor unions to push the U.S. government to support Tunisia during its COVID crisis. And I was just reading that and thinking, like, wow, these guys really have no clue how weak the labor movement is in the U.S. They do not have the leverage that they have in Tunisia. I mean, they clearly have a lot of leverage in Tunisia. I mean, they've sort of put themselves forward since 2011 as this sort of mediating role between secularists and Islamists, or mediating between different economic actors. In many ways, the union itself, it has a history in the national liberation struggle in Tunisia. It predated national liberation. In many ways, they divided themselves and distinguished themselves from the French left, saying the French left, don't realize that the problem of colonialism in Tunisia is unique. That the differences between the Tunisian worker and the French worker need to be addressed before you can really have an effective labor coalition internationally. So that was their position, and they're seen as being a defender in many ways of national sovereignty at key moments of history. At the same time, it's been co-opted in many ways at different times of history, whether co-opted by the Ben Ali regime, whether co-opted even into a neoliberal policy framework. I mean, we've seen heads of the head of UGTT at one point, saying, "Oh, we just need to do more foreign exports, and we need more foreign investments," which is really buying the economic vision that you would. Wouldn't be alien among World Bank economists, or IMF. So there's sort of a mixed bag. But in terms of defending the rights of workers, they're far stronger than you would see in the United States. Maybe closer to maybe what you might see in France, or other countries where there's sort of a strong labor movement. But that doesn't necessarily translate into the political realm. So that's the labor union. The student unions have had quite a strong presence throughout history. I mean, they've been at the forefront of things, and in recent years as well, you've seen them at the heads of protests. You know, whether it's against police repression, whether it's against austerity measures, student unions have been really key in organizing what is oftentimes wide popular dissatisfaction or even, anger and desperation against economic policies, and then trying to turn it into something maybe more more tangible. But as a result of that, oftentimes they are the biggest targets of police repression, particularly student unions. I mean, there's been student union leaders who have been arrested. Oftentimes they're arrested and then released immediately in the last few years. Just arresting them, sometimes arresting them for handing out flyers, that is enough to really make it difficult for them to organize, difficult for them to sort of come up with a coherent, set of policies or political vision that they might be able to implement. Makes it more difficult for them to just organize in general, or to find new people who might be amenable to their ideas or to their solutions. So that's sort of at the level of the unions. But then on the political parties, I mean, we have seen unfortunately the traditional left parties fail quite spectacularly at the polls. Unfortunately, internally, these are parties that when you go to meetings, you see a bunch of old men talking, at cafes, talking at a theoretical level, in many ways disconnected from people living in poor neighborhoods, disconnected from rural areas, from farmers, from people who would actually maybe be open to the idea of to some of their ideas, but unfortunately they're seen as either maybe elite, or they may be seen as sort of old boys clubs that are maybe in some ways more social clubs than they are about putting forward serious proposals, and that's really been reflected in the polls. I mean, that's why they've lost in many ways, and why we've seen maybe leftism at least going more into the Arab nationalist tradition with the Harakat al-Shaab, the People's Movement, doing better in the polls than clearly any of the other traditional secular leftist parties have done.
Yeah, I feel like we need to convene like a big panel across the region, because this is a problem that is obviously not isolated to Tunisia. It's also a lot of similarities from what you said exist in Lebanon, though the labor unions here don't have the kind of strength you talked about. But at least for the traditional political parties, leftist parties, having zero representation and really very, very little connection to people that they technically should be, appealing to. But I guess that's a conversation for another day. But I appreciate your analysis on that. And, before we wrap up here, I think it's important to, obviously things are happening quite quickly in Tunisia. And, perhaps by the time this recording goes up, things may have changed a bit, but that's why I left this till the end. But I guess, what is the layout? Like, what's happening right now in terms of, there's like a curfew in place, right?
Yeah.
And what do you expect will happen moving forward?
Yeah, the president's ruling by executive decree now. He's put out a few of them. There was a curfew. There's been a curfew for months. It's unfortunately, a curfew has basically often used by security forces to harass people, to ask for bribes, particularly in poorer neighborhoods. I mean, that's been the case. That's what we've heard from people. And certainly, we've seen it. And these are not necessarily respected by people who are in the elite. There's been sort of these weekend lockdowns, but if you have a hotel reservation, you're allowed to travel between cities. And if you have good connections, you're probably going to get an authorization to be able to drive around. So these are measures that aren't necessarily helping to stem the COVID infection. They haven't really been effective. They haven't been shown to be effective. There's no studies that have been done that show the effectiveness of it. But yet they're being put in place. And even though the president had originally had told the prime minister, when the prime minister had tried to first set a nightly curfew, the president had said, this is too early of a curfew. I want to push back because people are suffering socioeconomically. So at that time, he was very happy to sort of be the populist, you know, talk about the needs of the people. But now that he's in power, he's actually done the same thing. He's put the curfew much earlier. It's going to be 7 p.m. And it's going to be for a whole month. And it's going to be every day. So that's something that unfortunately is probably going to exacerbate inequalities immediately. You know, this may be something that he's doing to try and consolidate power to make sure that that opposition doesn't find itself organizing in other ways on the streets or something like that. You know, the prime minister has said he's fine with this. He's accepting the decision to be fired. But the parliament is still saying, you know, parliamentarians, particularly parties that were in power, parties that were in the majority, have put out statements saying that they condemn this. You know, Parliament seems to be the one that's really holding out. We've seen some institutions that have been really trying to push back against the president, you know, putting all the powers under himself. We've seen the higher judicial council saying, you know, he doesn't really have the power basically to be a prosecutor. They didn't say it quite directly, but they were basically saying, you know, him appointing himself a state prosecutor is not something that is really under the prerogatives of the executive power. We've seen the journalists union come out and say, you know, they've condemned what they saw was the shutting down of the Al Jazeera Arabic offices, and they've pointed to some attacks on journalists and threats to journalists and threats to freedom of the press in general. We've seen anti-corruption NGO iWatch, which has played a key role in the last few years, you know, saying that they would you know, want to see you know, real specifics on how this is going to be just a limited process, that the president doesn't stick to keeping power past a certain point. The union as well said we'd like to see this be within the bounds of constitutionality. So different institutions of the state that in many ways have, or different institutions that are maybe outside of the state, but oftentimes have a lot more legitimacy than Parliament did, or a lot more credibility, a lot more sort of faith as institutions than Parliament did, which are trying to carve out their independence from the president. And we'll see. We'll see if that's where the opposition is sort of is. I mean, you know, in any system, there's going to be power and opposition. And right now, we're going to see what those forms of opposition are going to look like.
And, you know, I've seen two different very black and white narratives taking place online. One of them is kind of coming from like the UAE, Saudi, Egyptian corner, promoting this idea that this is an uprising, right, against the Muslim Brotherhood. And as we know, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Egypt absolutely despise the Muslim Brotherhood. And then on the other side, you know, you have the sort of Turkish and Qatari corners pushing that this is a coup against the Muslim Brotherhood. Is there truth to any of these two sides? Do you think there's outside meddling taking place? You know, I've seen some people saying that there's certainly some online operations to push various narratives that don't look organic. What's your take on this?
There's a possibility. Yeah, I mean, there's a possibility that the president communicated at least, you know, his plans beforehand with UAE. Egypt, he visited Egypt not too long ago. You know, people were surprised by that. You know, this is people did not expect. The Egypt model, unfortunately, is quite popular in Tunisia. It does have a lot of popular support, despite the repression that we've seen in Egypt, despite the fact that you know, Egypt in many ways is not a democracy. In fact, maybe one of the most repressive countries in the region, but unfortunately, it does have quite a lot of support popularly here. People who see it as you know, this is a strong leader. There is unfortunately a desire for a strong leader to sort of cut through the corruption, a lot of the administrative blockages, the sort of the bickering without any real produced solutions that affect people's lives positively. So there's a possibility that, you know, maybe this the move was communicated by the president and his team in advance, as, you know, this is going to be something that maybe you should support, maybe you should not intervene against, because it's going to be a big blow to the Nahda, people in the Gulf what rulers in the Gulf might see as, you know, the international Muslim Brotherhood. This may have been a cover that, you know, allowed for international acceptance of this, but, you know, it's unclear. We're going to get more details, you know, probably years and years from now over what exactly happened. But it doesn't seem implausible.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that there's like a desire on the ground from some people for the Egyptian model. You mean like for like a military takeover? Or what do you mean by that exactly?
I mean, for sure in 2013, there were people calling for, I mean, you can't have a military takeover necessarily because the military, you know, just doesn't play that role. It doesn't have the capacity to do it.
Right.
You know, in Tunisia, it might be more like police in many ways who at that time were stronger. But, you know, in terms of what they see, I think there's an image that, you know, Sisi as in charge of Egypt has been able to assert or reassert some level of Egyptian sovereignty, that, you know, he's gotten rid of enemies and blockages, that Egypt is doing better economically. I mean, I don't believe this. I think a lot of this is propaganda, you know, that the Egyptian state is presenting to the world. But they've done quite a good job of propaganda, and people here certainly believe it. I mean, when they had that sort of, you know, the moving of the mummies, I mean, that was something that was shared widely in Tunisia as, you know, gosh, you know, these are the people that like respect their history and respect their past, and they have a state that works, and our state is falling apart and no longer working. So there is this sort of like appeal to this, you know, this fantasy that if you just have, you know, one person who's going to be able to solve all these issues. I mean, Tunisia's problems are far too big for one person to solve, whether it's Kais Saied, it's far too big even for the military to solve. There may be some things that the military will be better at, you know, perhaps vaccine rollout. They seem to be doing a better job with that. They seem to be doing a fairly good job of supporting existing health services with auxiliary military support. But, you know, definitely there's far too many problems and far too complex to really have, you know, the military or Kais Saied be able to solve them.
Yeah, I would say that that's actually like a common narrative I hear more and more, especially recently, about Egypt's economy is just booming. Sisi's doing something right. At least I hear that commentary in Lebanon as well. So definitely some level of successful propaganda taking place to some degree. So I guess, you know, to end on, where would you tell people to look for accurate and useful information and analysis on what's taking place in Tunisia?
We try as best as we can. We're still a small and new outlet, but mishkila.org, I mean, we have you know, quite a backlog. I mean, we try to catch people up with the context. You know, if you don't really know anything about Tunisia, you know, we try to make sure that even readers who don't know something about Tunisia will at least have, you know, all of the links, all of the context that they need to understand new developments. So, you know, we've been publishing for 2 years. We have reporting on many different subjects. So I do recommend that if you are interested in learning about Tunisia, you know, we try and do it from a perspective where we're writing, you know, also to a Tunisian audience. We're not writing necessarily for an international audience. I think a lot of the, unfortunately, international coverage, you know, of Tunisia has been, you know, trying to put it into a very narrow lens of, you know, I get called whenever there's a bomb that explodes. You know, it's about, you know, oh, it's terrorism.
Or an alleged coup.
Or an alleged coup, yes. You know, but as a result of that, I mean, I know people who, you know, all they know about Tunisia or perhaps other countries in the region is terrorism. I mean, because that's the only thing that they've ever seen in the paper that they read that comes from Tunisia. So it gives an extremely distorted view, unfortunately, of the situation. So we try and make sure that we're not trying to think of the Western audience in mind, but to try and think of, you know, how do we understand what's going on, and how do we basically tell the story in a way that puts forward the voices of is my audio still going?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. To put forward the story in a way that may make sure that you know, we actually bring the voices of people who oftentimes aren't heard, and put them into context with other voices. You know, even putting them against officials or people who might never actually give the time of day to the people that we're talking to. But you know, actually put them into dialogue in the space of one article.
No, it's so important what you're doing. And I'm actually a little bit curious before we actually do end. I know I keep adding questions here, but can you tell everybody a little bit about your background? How did you end up in Tunisia doing this work?
So I was working, well, I was working for an English language newspaper in Istanbul in 2009, 2010. And actually when the revolution in 2011 in Tunisia happened, I was the only person in the newsroom who had some contacts in Tunisia and some French. So I was actually calling some of the key people right after the revolution to do coverage there. And then at some point, you know, I decided that I wanted to leave Turkey. I thought that Tunisia was really interesting. What was going on was really interesting, and I came as a freelance English language journalist, and I've been sort of covering Tunisia since then, since 2011 on and off.
Well, that's very cool. Thank you so much, Fadl Alireza, the founder and editor-in-chief of Mishkal, who everybody, again, should check out, also journalist and researcher. Thank you for giving us your time and breaking it all down.
Thank you.